Welcome everyone to the June session, the final session of the 18th season of the Denver Community College's Torah for Tycoons program. Thank you, as always, to the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we near the close of our 18th season. As always, I want to encourage everyone here to consider having a conversation with one of the Kollel rabbis, myself, or any other Kollel rabbi about the Kollel's Live On Life and Legacy program, which continues through Rose Community Foundation and is helping the Kollel and many other organizations create future financial stability through planned giving, such as wills, estate planning, and endowments. So if you've got any questions about that, please feel free to reach out or to chat with me. That'll be great. There is a class outline for this class, which will not be shared during the class itself, but later on I will share the link if you want to get a hold of that outline later on for the CLE credits and so on. That outline is part of the course, so I will give a link for that. It will also be included in the email that we will send out in the next day or two with the recording. We'll include that as well. Also, I plan on posting the link for the CLE credits form a little bit later as well on the chat, and it will be included in that email. With that, I'd like to introduce our presenter this evening, and that is Mr. Harry Rothenberg, Esquire. He's a plaintiff's personal injury attorney and partner at the Rothenberg Law Firm, LLP. I just want to add, I had the pleasure of making Mr. Rothenberg's acquaintance through the Olami Rabbis Can Run program, which some of you have heard that I participated in this past January, and some of you read about it in the IJN as well. So Harry spoke for the participating rabbis at the event, and I later reached out to him about his talk there, and that evolved into this class this evening. So that's a little bit of the background for how this class came about. I'm most grateful to Mr. Rothenberg for making time in his busy schedule to deliver this class. I look forward to a great class. Without further ado, I hand over the floor to Mr. Rothenberg.
Thank you very much for the introduction and the opportunity. And thank you to each of you for tuning in. I know you have many other options for your evening entertainment. I'm also very impressed to hear that this is the 18th season. So you should have a lot of hatzlacha in continuing this great thing that you're doing. So I don't think you can disagree with the statement that when Moses came down from the mountain after God gave him the Torah up on Mount Sinai, that the world changed. Even if you don't believe in Moses and you don't believe in God and you don't believe in the divine authorship of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, you can't argue the fact that many of the laws that appear in the Torah have been adopted or codified, at least in part, in civilizations across the globe, particularly here in the United States, and really just every civilization since that time, particularly with respect to the area of law in which I practice. I represent clients. I always say that I meet the nicest people in the world for the worst possible reasons. I represent people who have lost parents, who have lost spouses, who in the most tragic instances have lost children. I represent or have represented people who have lost arms and legs and sight and hearing, the ability to walk, the ability to talk, the ability to think. And when I ask a jury, or a defense attorney or a judge or an adjuster to award money for any one of my grievously injured clients' pain and suffering, or for their lost wages, or their medical bills, or their scarring, or their disfigurement, those requests sound like they're coming straight out of chapter 21 of the book of Exodus. Because if you take a look in Sefer Shemos, there is a listing of the different types of damage someone has to pay when they hurt someone. And it's awfully similar to the types of things that we ask juries for under American tort law. And also, as explained in Babylonian Talmud, in the Talmud Bavli, in the tractate of Bava Kamma, there's an entire tractate that is dedicated to damages, and it walks through many of the same types of things, the pain and suffering and the embarrassment and the disfigurement and the lost wages and the medical bills and the like. So two questions, though. First, why is it that it was only partially adopted, wasn't adopted completely? You know, if you look carefully, you will see some marked differences between Torah law, halacha, and secular law. And number two, how do we understand the logic behind the laws, behind Jewish law? And there's one answer for both questions, which is that in the secular world, we are doing the best that we can in a world that is by definition imperfect. And it's imperfect because it's run by human beings, where in the world of Jewish law, we aspire to perfection. And even though we know we will likely fall short, or if we're honest, we know we're going to fall short at times, both in the criminal realm and in the civil realm, we know that we have the man upstairs as a backup, as a parachute. And so we rely on him. So sometimes those two systems, Jewish law and secular law, coexist very peacefully, sometimes awkwardly, and sometimes not at all, not even a little bit. So I'll start just as an aside. Some of you may have heard the story before, but if you haven't, I always enjoy telling it. The first time that I ever saw the potential for conflict between my chosen profession and my decision to be visibly Jewish in that chosen profession happened in the first class on the first day at Harvard Law School. The professor greeted us. He calmed us all down, asked us how many of us had read the book 1L that had this scene in it chronicling Scott Turow's first year at Harvard Law School. The professor on the first day would ask three people, look at each other, because by the time we get to graduation, only one of you is still going to be here because two-thirds would flunk out. How many of you saw the movie or the TV show Paper Chase about this tyrant of a professor at Harvard Law School who would terrorize people? And he said, I want you to know there may have been a time when it was like that. It no longer is. We're not here to humiliate you. We're not here to embarrass you. We're here to educate. We may even entertain you. And you could feel in the room like everybody exhaling like, okay, that sounds better than what we heard or what was dramatized on TV and in the and in books. He says, however, we are going to use the Socratic method. I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to call on a guinea pig. I mean, a volunteer to answer, and then a question answered back and forth. I'm thinking Socratic method. I thought the rabbis invented that, but whatever. Give Socrates the credit. He says, okay, so let's begin your legal education. I think to myself, I had taken 2 years off in between college and law school. I'd gone to yeshiva in Israel between Columbia and Harvard. And so I was just really easing back into my secular academic career. And I didn't want to be the first guy called on. So I'm looking down at my notes. I am not going to make eye contact, because if I make eye contact, I might look eager. And so he says, okay, as he's pacing the room, he says, who can tell me, what did the Smith court say about non-mutual defensive collateral estoppel? Now, in law school, unlike in college, you're assigned readings before the first day and you're expected to be able to answer them immediately. I had another professor who walked in the first day and immediately started calling on people. You may have heard of her, Professor Elizabeth Warren, who later went on to greater fame. Okay, there were professors like that. Wilkins wasn't. He gave us this introduction, calmed us down. He says, okay, what did the Smith court say? Non-mutual defensive collateral estoppel. And he stops, and I can see his shadow is over my notebook. I'm sitting in the second row, and I'm thinking, this may not end well. And he says, okay, how about you, Mr. Jew? And it was like the earth opened and I fell in. Like, he gave us this whole speech. He's not going to embarrass us. He calls me Mr. Jew because I'm wearing a beanie on my head. That's crazy. Isn't that discriminatory? And I don't even remember what the question was. And the next thing I know, the fellow sitting directly in front of me starts answering the question. Asian fellow, Thomas Jew, J-O-O. Now, it's exactly how it happened. During that, you know, second or so or 2 seconds that it took Tom Jew to clear his throat and start answering the question, I definitely regretted my decision. Said to myself, why didn't I wear my Phillies hat? I'm from Philadelphia. Why did I have to wear my beanie? It was the first and last time I ever felt that way. So that was an example, a crude example of how they can sometimes not coexist. But the real reason they don't coexist, stories aside, is that they have completely different goals. The ultimate goal in the United States secular legal system is resolution. Not to sound like we're on the ball field, but if you speak to trial lawyers, it often does sound like we're on the ball field. We want winners, and it's not that we want losers, but inevitably, in order to get winners, you also need losers. Somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. A defendant has to get convicted or acquitted. A plaintiff has to be to win or lose, meaning the defendant has to be found negligent or not. And if he's found negligent, the plaintiff either walks away with money or doesn't. We need a winner and a loser. And as Martin Luther King Jr. famously said in his letter from Birmingham jail, quoting a prior author, he said that justice too long delayed is justice denied, meaning we need resolution. You can't just keep kicking the can down the road. Somebody's got to win every case. Now, what can happen is that you can have a terribly unjust outcome. There's an organization called the Innocence Project. They use DNA testing and other methods to exonerate wrongfully convicted people. And since its inception in 1992, it claims that its methods, it and other people using similar methods, have exonerated over 375 individuals who were wrongfully convicted, including 21 who served time on death row, meaning an innocent person was scheduled to be executed in their individual state before, thankfully, they were cleared of a crime that they did not commit. On average, the people that they've acquitted served 14 years in jail for crimes they didn't commit. That can happen because when you want resolution, you can make mistakes and you can have people who are unjustly accused and unjustly acquitted, convicted, and they spend time in jail unless they're fortunate enough to have somebody like the Innocent Project show up and help them out. In halach, in Torah law, that's not our goal. Our ultimate goal is not resolution. And with respect to Martin Luther King Jr., sometimes you have to delay justice and sometimes you don't get justice because the ultimate goal is truth. It's not resolution. We're not looking for winners and losers. We're looking for the truth. Of course, sometimes there are winners and losers. Of course, sometimes people go to Beit Din, they go to the Jewish court, and there's a winner and a loser. It's not to say we can't have a winner and a loser, but that's not our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is drilling down and trying to ferret out what is the truth. So, and that means that even if there's no clear winner, and it means even if there's a delay, and the reason for that, there's a theological, there's a religious reason for that, is that we rely on God to figure out the rest. So let's say somebody was supposed to get money and we weren't sure and he didn't get awarded money. So God will make it up to him. Okay. And let's say somebody was supposed to get, you know, was supposed to be punished for some crime and he wasn't punished and he got off. So God will take care of him. Like we have that backup. We have that parachute that doesn't exist in secular law. So we're willing to delay things. We're willing to give up on resolution so that we can achieve or try our best to achieve, truth. Matter of fact, there's a discussion in the Babylonian Talmud, in a Mishnah, in the Tractate of Makos. The rabbis have a debate over what is called a violent Jewish court. So one rabbi says that any court that convicts someone to the death penalty, a Jewish court, it once in 7 years is called a violent court. Another rabbi says no. Once in 70 years, it's considered a violent court, meaning it's got to be that uncommon to convict somebody of the death penalty. And then Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon go further and they say, if we were on the court, we never would kill anybody. And they go through that how they would ask certain questions to make sure that it would be impossible. Because, for example, they asked the witnesses who testified that they saw Reuven kill Shimon and they gave him the halachic warning telling him that if you do this, you will be subject to the death penalty. And the judges would ask questions. For example, are you certain that Shimon, right before he was stabbed, didn't have a problem with his heart that was about to end his life? Well, no, how are we supposed to answer that? So they'd ask questions in a way that would ensure that even a person who was otherwise deserving of conviction wouldn't be convicted because that's how worried they were about accidentally killing an innocent person. There's a case also in Talmud Bavli and Bava Metzia. It's called Shnayim Ochzim B'Talis. Two people are holding a talis. So what happens is that two people show up in court. It's a funny case. It's like something out of a cartoon. And they're both holding on to a talis at the same time. They show up in court. They're both holding on to the talis. What's going on, guys? And this guy says, I found it and it's mine. The other guy says, I found it and it's mine. So the court makes them take an oath, a fascinating oath. They each swear that they own no less than half of the garment. And that can be true. Because it is possible there was a photo finish and they did both find an ownerless garment at the exact same time, grabbed it at the same time, in which case they would jointly own it. So they both swear honestly in their minds. They're swearing honestly. I believe that garment's mine. I think I got it first. So I'm swearing that I own no less than half of it. They take that oath and then the court splits them, either physically cuts the garment in half or sells it and each get half the money. They split the object. However, if those same two guys come to court and they're both holding the same talis and each one says, I wove that garment. In other words, I sewed it. I knitted that garment myself. Now we know there's a liar in the courtroom. It is possible that they both found an ownerless item and they both grabbed it at the same time, but it's not possible that they both wove it. We don't let them swear because if we let them swear, we are letting a liar take an oath in our courtroom. And we're not going to allow that. So we're not going to let them take the oath. So in the United States, look in contrast. I don't remember the last case I had that went to trial. We didn't have a liar in the courtroom. Practically every case, every time you have an intersectional collision, my client puts this, depending on whether they're observant or not, they either swear or they affirm on a stack of Bibles, swear the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I had the green light. That guy had the red light. And then the other guy, the defendant, goes and swears, no, 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 no. I had the green light. and he had the red light. Now, it's possible that they both really, really thought they had the green light, but you tell me. Statistically improbable. Chances are one of them knows that he went to a red light and he's swearing, taking an oath that he had the green light and he's lying. And we have no problem with that. We have no problem letting people both take oaths to tell the truth and contradict each other in a way where it's clear that somebody's lying. Reason being, we got to get a result. We need a winner and we need a loser. Torah system is different. We're interested in the truth. So I want to go through with you a case and show you how this went down and how it worked out in the under the secular regime that I can't imagine would have happened. I don't know what they would have done with it, but I know they wouldn't have done this. So here's the case. There was a young man, our plaintiff, his name is Lamont Wilson, and he is walking at a construction site. He's underneath a scaffold, and a sharp object, some kind of construction debris, because it's an active construction site, hits him in the eye, creating permanent partial blindness in that eye. And so we do what every good plaintiff's personal injury does in that type of case. After he hires us, we sue everybody. And I mean everybody, because that's our job. How are we supposed to know which machine it was operated by which person? So we sue the owner of the property, we sue the general contractor, and we sue 7 subcontractors. So we've got 9 different defendants. And we send out our discovery requests, our standard list of discovery requests, send us your permits and send us the list of employees who were there and tell us what job you were doing and when the dates you were at, you were there, et cetera. So they all respond and they send us their discovery requests, but for one of the 9 defendants doesn't respond. So my brother files a motion, standard motion that you file in New York State Supreme Court and in other states saying, Your Honor, this particular defendant did not respond to our discovery requests. And so I'd like you to strike the answer. If the judge strikes an answer, it's the most draconian punishment that a judge can issue, because if a defendant gets an answer stricken, then the plaintiff wins. End of story. Doesn't matter whether you would or wouldn't have won in front of a jury. The jury no longer hears liability. You go straight to an inquest, and a judge or a jury puts a number on that case. The plaintiff automatically wins. So judges are very reluctant to strike an answer. You really got to do something wrong to have your answer stricken. So we show up to argue the motion. The judge says, what's going on? You didn't answer, okay? Even after you filed the motion, apparently, you didn't. I mean, did you answer since then? He says, Your Honor, mea culpa, my bad. I didn't answer, but don't worry. I'm absolutely going to answer. Judge says, fine, write up an order. You have 30 days to answer. Okay, my brother writes up the order. The judge has signed it. They have 30 days to answer. 30 days come and 30 days go. And the lawyer still doesn't respond. So my brother files another motion. He renews his original motion and he shows the exhibits. He says, Your Honor, here was our original request. We went in, we argued this. You'll recall, you issued an order saying they had 30 days. 30 days came and went. Please strike their answer. And so now it gets scheduled for a hearing. We show up at the hearing. The judge says, don't tell me you didn't answer by now. He says, no, I didn't. I had this excuse. The dog ate my homework. I forgot. I was sick. I was on vacation. Whatever excuse he has, okay? Judge says, you really got to answer this discovery, okay? Now write up another order, and this time you better give it to him. 30 days, and that's it. So my brother says to the judge, well, 1 second, Your Honor. He had the original time period. He ignored it. And then we filed a motion. He gave him another 30 days. It's just not fair to me to make me come back. What if he doesn't answer? Judge, I'm sure he's going to answer. I said, well, what if he doesn't? Can't we write in this order that if I don't get the discovery within 30 days, his answer is stricken? The judge said, yeah, it's a good idea. Put it in there. In terms of defense attorney, you got 30 days. If that discovery is not in within 30 days, your answer is stricken. Don't worry, Your Honor. It'll be there tomorrow. Would you believe that another 30 days come and another 30 days go and the guy doesn't respond, never sends in his discovery? So my brother files the order with notice of entry that we now have a default and asks for an inquest, an immediate hearing on damages against that defendant. Okay. In the meantime, while this is playing out, an eagle-eyed defense attorney for one of the other 8 defendants that's in the case said, you know, I looked at the hospital records, voluminous hospital records, very carefully, and it says that in the hospital, they recovered the piece of metal that was in this fellow's eye. I'd like to see it. So my brother says, well, we'll find out if they still have it. Contacts the hospital and they still have it. Why didn't they send it to us with the original medical records? We don't know. They have it in some records room. So we request it. Great. And we make an agreement that each of us and an expert hired by us and an expert jointly hired by the defendants is going to get a chance to examine that piece of memory, see what it is. If we figure out what it is, we may be able to pin it on a particular defendant. Hey, that came from a jackhammer. We know it must have been you. You were the only person jackhammering. Hey, that came from some other type of device that only you used. So we examine it via our expert, and they examine it via their expert. And both experts agree it was a BB from a BB gun. Had absolutely nothing to do with the construction site. Some lunatic must have been shooting a BB gun in the neighborhood. And our guy, who I absolutely believe, because he was found from the initial call from the ambulance, was at that construction site. He said, I got hit in the eye by something from the construction site. I don't believe for a second that he knew how it had happened, but apparently he had gotten shot by a stray BB that somebody in the neighborhood was shooting, which means we have no case. We have no case against the owner. We have no case against the general contractor. We have no case against the subcontractor. Somebody in the neighborhood was shooting BB. It had nothing to do with the construction site. So reluctantly, we are forced to sign stipulations of discontinuance, letting out all the defendants because the case is over, except for one. We sign for 8 defendants. The lawyer for the 9th defendant calls my brother and says, what's going on? Why didn't you sign the stipulation of discontinuance for me? Marilla says, what are you talking about? We won against you. He says, what do you mean you won against me? He says, your answer's stricken. Once your answer's stricken, you have no defense. I can't commit malpractice and let you out of the case. We won the case. He says, that would be fraud. You don't have a case. It was a BB. Marilla says, listen, I have a client, okay? Suppose it was clear that it was from your client and I had missed the statute of limitations and I filed a day late. Would you let me file a day late? He says, of course not. So I had the same thing. I can't let you out. The law says you lost, we won. We're going to inquest against you. The guy goes absolutely berserk. And then a new insurance company shows up. If you haven't figured out who that is, it's the insurance company for the lawyer because the lawyer has committed malpractice. It was the lawyer who didn't respond to the discovery request, not his client. And so the lawyer's insurance carrier shows up, happens to be an adjuster that I know, calls me up and says, listen, I can't believe this case, but we're doing this one time. I'm making you one offer. It's a take it or leave it offer. I'm sick that I have to pay on this because I think it's ridiculous. I think it's fraud. I said, enough with the sermonizing. Okay. The law is the law. Your answer is stricken. What's the offer? It says $500,000. So I speak to my brother. Speaks to his client. We speak to our appellate attorney who says, guys, you got this one. So if it's worth more, you should not take it. And so we reject it. We said, no. I tell him, we'll take $1 million. We're not taking $500,000. He says, you're crazy. You're sure your client, it's life-changing amount of money. I said, we're sure. Fine. So they file their motion for appeal. And the appellate court says that we're right. We win. In the meantime, we had gone to an inquest and the judge had awarded $1 million. The appellate court knocked it down, said it's a little high, knocked it down to $750,000. But in the meantime, interest is ticking at 9% a year. And now they file a motion for a writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals in New York, the highest Court of Appeals in New York, that like the Supreme Court decides which cases to hear. It's not an automatic appeal. That court decides whether or not it's going to grant cert, whether it's going to listen to a case. And our appellate attorney says, guys, don't worry. There is no way that the court is granting. This is straightforward, stricken answer. There's no defense. And the appellate court grants cert, to which obviously we're not just shocked. We're very worried because if they granted cert, it means at least one judge is concerned about this. So we go up to the Court of Appeals. Our appellate attorney argues it. And in a split decision, I think it was a 3-2 decision, two of the judges say they would fine for the defense. Because fraud is different. Fraud's not a defense. Fraud means there was never a case at the outset. But a 3-judge majority says a stricken answer is a stricken answer is a stricken answer. We have to have that penalty for defendants who don't obey the discovery rules. The answer is stricken. The judgment stands. And with interest, it was up to, I don't know what else, $1.2 million, $1.3 million. And we collected every penny of it. Now, that can only happen in a secular courtroom because we're interested in resolution. We need winners. We need losers. We have these rules. You got to follow them. Even though I have to believe, I don't know what would happen. I have to update this class and ask the next time I find somebody who's an Av Beis Din, or who's a judge in a Jewish court, but I can't imagine that in a Jewish court, something like that would stand because at the end of the day, it's very clear that the entity who was found responsible did not do anything wrong. It was from a BB. Now you might say, well, maybe even in the Beis Din, it was malpractice. I don't know. I leave it to the Rav. It's something you could talk about afterwards. But I have to believe my educated guess is that it'll be a very different result in a court. And I think that's a case that highlights that difference between search for truth versus a desire for resolution. Next thing I want to talk about is the width of the line between truth and falsehood. So the disciplinary rules for lawyers in New York, and it's similar in all 50 states, say as following. A lawyer or firm shall not engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. So in other words, you can't step over the line. You can sort of reach over, like if you're a wide receiver and you're tall in the NFL, as long as you have both feet in, if you toe tap, you can be reaching over the line as long as you tap your toes. Meaning don't actually lie. You can go right up to that line, but don't lie. The Torah, in contrast, phrases it very differently. It doesn't say don't lie. It says it as a do, not as a don't do. You would think the Torah would say don't lie. It says something much stronger. It says, midvar sheker tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood. You can't even go up to the line. You have to distance yourself from deceit, distance yourself from falsehood. It's not enough to just refrain from lying. And so wherever the line is between truth and falsehood, you can't even step anywhere near it. Now, the problem is that many laws are written in a way that put tremendous pressure on a witness to lie. So I'll give you an example. In an injury case, I can ask the jury to award damages for past pain and suffering and future pain and suffering and past medical bills and future medical bills. Whereas in a wrongful death case in New York and in many other states, New Jersey is similar, the only measure of damages are lost wages. So if you have somebody who's a high wage earner, that can be a significant case. But if you have a stay-at-home mother or if you have a child, it's not a significant case because they weren't, or somebody elderly who's not working, retiree, they're not making any money. And the other thing I can ask the jury to award is for conscious pain and suffering. Conscious pain and suffering. So you have cases sometimes where the injuries are indescribably horrific, but it was obvious that the person was unconscious very quickly and then they died. And so it's limited what we can ask for. The proof of conscious pain and suffering can dramatically increase the value of the case. So there's a sick, demented, morbid joke that has been shared for years by defense attorneys and insurance adjusters in New York that goes as follows. If you run someone over and you injure them horrifically, the smartest thing you could do financially is to put the car in reverse and finish the job. Because somebody who's catastrophically injured and has multiple surgeries and is crippled and is going to live and require a lot of future care, that case could be a $10 million case, a $20 million case, or more. Whereas if somebody dies, unless they're a very significantly high wage earner, it could be a $500,000 case or $1 million case or $2 million case because there's no future pain and suffering and there's no future medical costs. So often, particularly in a car crash, by the time the paramedics arrive, the victim's unresponsive. And so there's no mention of pain and suffering in the report. They arrive, Glasgow Coma Scale is a 3, meaning they're completely unconscious and non-responsive. And so our job, to the extent that we're going to try to get some kind of large award from a jury or in settlement for conscious pain and suffering, is made very difficult because how are we going to show that there was any degree of consciousness? And keep in mind that because of the way the law is written and because jurors look to award in wrongful death cases, it tugs at the heartstrings when someone dies and the judge tells them you can only award for conscious pain and suffering. They look for conscious pain and suffering. So if we can show any, even if it's very brief, it makes a huge difference with respect to settlement value. Ironically, often the only way to show it is through testimony of our clients. Because very often you'll have an eyewitness who's a husband, who's a wife, who's a brother, who's a sister, who's a mother, who's a father, who's a son or a daughter. So there's enormous pressure on that person to say, yes, I heard my, whatever the relationship is, groaning. I heard them moaning. I heard them speaking. They were obviously in awful pain. And there's pressure on the plaintiff's attorney to suggest to them, you saw some pain and suffering, right? You saw some, they were talking, right? They were wheezing, right? They were saying something to you, right? And it's very difficult because I can't do that because I have this fashion statement on my head and I'm supposed to distance myself from falsehood. So what I can do is I can tell them the law, but then they have to make the decision. I can, and it's interesting because conversely, there are people who have this on their head who are defense attorneys. There's enormous pressure on them to counsel their client to lie the other way. I have no doubt that there have been cases where the defendant, who's often the only witness, imagine you have a pedestrian knock down, somebody's driving the car, they hit a pedestrian. The person who's I'm suing may be the only one. They were there first. They saw it happen. They may have seen signs of conscious pain and suffering, but their lawyers are saying, are you crazy? You can't tell that to the plaintiff's attorney. You have to say, oh no, they were completely unconscious, completely non-responsive. I remember one time in my career, at the deposition, I was representing the estate of an 18-year-old, beautiful young man, wonderful young man, you know, as his parents and his siblings had described them to me. And there was a delivery driver, his early 20s, was making a left-hand turn. He told a police officer later that there was a glare from the sun, so he couldn't see. Why he continued to make the turn when he couldn't see, I don't know. So he continued to make the turn, hit our 18-year-old's client, and killed him. And so by the time the paramedics got there, completely non-responsive, there's no indication of conscious pain and suffering at all. No eyewitnesses. There were some eyewitnesses that got there afterwards, but nobody that could tell us, yes, we saw him suffering. So my only chance for a conscious pain and suffering claim is to ask the defendant. So of course I ask, and I know he's been prepared by the defense attorney, who I am sure has jumped up and down to tell him you didn't see anything. He was out of it, not a word. And he was very honest. He was very shaken up. He was crying at the deposition. And I said to him, did you see him after you struck him? He said, yeah. I said, when did you see him? He said, I got out of my car and I saw him on the ground. I said, was he moving? He said, yeah. I said, what was he doing? He said, well, it looked like he was trying to roll over. I said, was he in pain? He said, yeah, it was obvious that he was in a lot of pain. I said, did he say anything to you? He said, yes. I said, what did he say? He said, well, when I came up close to him, to see how he was, you know, I heard him saying to me, help me. Now, I will tell you that the defense attorney looked like he was going to swallow his notebook and his pen. Because you can imagine how the value of the case just instantly skyrocketed because his own defendant, well, all he had to do was shut up and say, I didn't see anything, was honest, under oath, and said, yeah, you know, he was moving, he was writhing, he was in pain, and he was saying, help me. And you can imagine, you know, what that does in front of a jury. So the settlement value was significantly higher after that. But that's the rare case that proves the rule that a practitioner answers to a higher authority or any attorney with a sensitive, properly calibrated moral compass who tries to be faithful to the secular laws that encourage zealous advocacy is walking a very fine tightrope. And sometimes, you know, is going to have to refuse cases where at the outset, a potential client, I have this all the time, you know, says to me, well, this is how it happened, but I could say, you know, if you want me to, I could say this, and I'm not interested in that case. You know, you can't in that situation when you walk in that tightrope, you can't suggest that the client lie. You can't stay silent because you have an absolute obligation to inform the client of the law, even though once I tell the client I know or potential client I know they may lie. And so I explain the law and I explain to them the gravity of the situation. And then I tell them how important it is to think it through. And then I tell them, but I want to hear the truth. So I'll give you another example of this that just happened last winter. I have a very close friend lives nearby in the community where I live in Passaic, New Jersey. And he called me up and he said, you're not going to believe what happened. I was walking out of so-and-so's house and he named another close friend. Three of us were all very close friends and it was icy and I slipped and I fell and I shattered my wrist. He sent me on WhatsApp a picture of I see these all day long. I know the difference. The x-ray showing the after effects of the surgery that he had. It's called an ORIF surgery, an open reduction in internal fixation of hardware. A tremendous amount of plate. He had many, many screws because they had to reconstruct his entire wrist. And he said to me, do I have a case? And I said, I'm going to tell you the law in New Jersey. And then you're going to tell me what happened. The law in New Jersey is as follows. If you were walking down his steps on your way out and you slipped on his steps because he failed to get rid of the snow or ice that had accumulated. And this was already a few days after the last snow. It wasn't like it was a storm that was in progress. And that's what caused you to fall while you were still on the steps. Then you absolutely have a case and you can sue it. I said, however, if you made it down the steps and you put your foot on the public sidewalk, there is no case. You can't sue him and you can't sue the municipality. Okay. And he said, well, how much are we talking about? I said, why don't you tell me what happened? He said, no, I need to know. How much are we talking about? I said, okay, I'll tell you what we're talking about. And I explained to him that obviously if you can't sue, that's a zero. And if you can sue, you're talking about conservatively several hundred thousands of dollars. Okay. Not $1 million, you know, unless he would need additional surgeries, but very comfortably, you know, a crooked number, not a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 type number. And he said, I slipped on the sidewalk. And you can imagine, right? You know, it takes quite the person. It was literally right when I got on the sidewalk. So all he has to do is back up the story a half step, just one step up. I slipped on the last step. You sure it was the last step? Absolutely. It was a step. I slipped off the last step. And he's looking at, you know, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, less than my fee. He said, no, it was a sidewalk. And he told the truth. As a fellow traveler. Next thing I want to talk about is, I'll ask this in sort of poetic fashion, but I mean it, is what is the price of one's soul? So negotiation, you know, particularly at significant dollar figures, often requires nerves of steel, and it requires a willingness or an ability to bluff. You're playing poker. You really are playing poker, or to mislead as to your actual bottom line. And so the law, places limits depending on the mode of resolution. But the question is, does Jewish law extend the limits as far? And if it does, so what's the moral cost? What's the psychological cost? What's the emotional cost? So what happened was, and I could give you many examples, dozens of examples of this, but this one's a particularly extreme example. I was representing a fellow who had suffered a traumatic brain injury. Or so we claimed. Now, I can say he suffered a traumatic brain injury because I know that's what happened, but the defense attorneys absolutely disagreed. Our doctors, his doctors, treating doctors, all examined him and said, he has a brain injury. And he can't go back to work. He did go back to work for a while. They had to reassign him to a less demanding job, and then eventually they fired him and then couldn't go back to work again. He was in his 30s. Their doctors all said, they agreed, that he was malingering, he was exaggerating, he was lawsuiting. He was interested in secondary gain, meaning that he doesn't really have a brain injury. He's faking it to try to get money. And as soon as we settle this case or the jury gives him money, he'll go back to work. So it's very tough. This is not like a fracture, and he did not have a skull fracture. So there was no x-ray I could hold up to the jury and say, you see, look at that fracture. You see that bone that's supposed to be like this, and it's like this. And you see all the hardware? There was no hardware. There's no surgery. So if a jury buys the brain injury, they might award him millions of dollars. If the jury doesn't, they might give him, I don't know, you know, he had some pain and suffering. Just give him $100,000, $200,000. So I sat with him and his wife for a good long time. Once we got a trial date, the defense attorney had asked if we would be willing to do a mediation. And we had said yes. At a mediation, both sides appear, typically in front of a retired judge. And the judge tries to knock down my demand and then increase their offer. And if those two numbers meet, so we have a settled case. So when I sat down with him and his wife, I said, look, I'm going to make my recommendation. You haven't done this before. I have. My recommendation is this. If they hit $1,000,005, I think you should accept it. Now, it's your choice. You might come back to me and say, no, we want more. You might come back to me and say, no, we're willing to take less. But the reason I think $1,000,005 is that my fee is a third. So putting aside my costs so that I don't complicate the numbers, you take off a third from $1,000,005 and you're at $1,000,000. I think $1,000,000 is too much to go to Vegas and put it on red or to Atlantic City. It's too much to gamble. A jury might award you more, but they might not. So that's my recommendation, is of course we should try to get more and hopefully we'll get a lot more. But if that's the bottom line, I think you should take it. And so they spend time thinking about it. I said, don't tell me now, but I want you to think about it before the mediation, because they're going to want a yes or a no when they get to their final number. So they think about it a lot and they say, of course we hope for more, but $1,000,005, we will take it. We'll be happy with that. Great. We go to the mediation. And if any of you have ever been to an auction, or if you've been to, you know, to a synagogue with the rabbi when they sell off the aliyahs during the holidays, do I hear 100 and 150? Do I hear 250? You in the back, 300, 300 looking for 400, 400 looking for 500. So as the day goes on, the numbers are going up, and it's 500 and it's 750 and it's 850. And finally it's $1,000,000. And thank God we crossed the magic $1,000,000 threshold. And we're at $1,200,000, $1,300,000, $1,400,000. And the judge comes back and says, okay, I have their final offer, $1,500,000. So I go back to speak to the client. I say, okay. They just, they said they made their final offer. It's $1,500,000. And he like hugs his wife. He's like, we did it. We're settled. I said, no, we're not settled. So what do you mean? We said $1,500,000. We're going to take it. I said, we're not taking it. We're rejecting it. He says, what do you mean we're rejecting it? I said, we're rejecting it because there's more money in that room. He said, but they said it's their final offer. I said, I know they said it's their final offer, but whenever a defense attorney or an insurance adjuster says for the first time it's our final offer, what I hear, it's interesting. What I hear is this is our most recent offer. It's not their final offer. So I said, you sure? I'm sure. So I went back in, told the judge, client rejects it. And they went back. And then their final offer became $1,750,000. Then their final offer became $2,000,000. Their final offer became $2,250,000. When their final offer became $2,500,000, the client said, listen, now we're taking it, right? I said, we're not taking it. So what do you mean? We're $1,000,000 past what we said. I said, you hired me, like every one of my clients, to get you the maximum recovery. No one has ever hired me saying, you know, get me an okay recovery. Person got hurt very badly. They want the maximum recovery. I'm telling you, this is not my first rodeo. There is more money in that room. But they said it's their final offer. Said they said that five times. It's not 275. And then at 275, the judge said, the defense attorney wants to speak to you alone. Well, that's fine. Went into a separate room. He said, listen, I don't know if I can do it. If I can get you 29, would that settle it? I said, no. If you can get me 3, it'll settle it. And he did. And they got 3 in this case, settled for $3 million. So now you tell me what happened to Midvar Sheker Tirchak. You're supposed to distance yourself from lies. And here I got a client saying, take it, take it, take it. And I'm walking and telling the judge, my client rejected it. And that sounds like a lie. Okay. So the first time I was in one of these situations in mediation, I felt horrible afterwards. And I went to speak to the Rosh Yeshiva in Pasek, a very, very well-known rabbi. And I explained to him the situation. He asked me many questions, great questions. And he said, here's my opinion. If this was at a trial, you certainly can't do that. First of all, I assume it would be foolish because if the jury or judge would see you lying, I'm sure it would hurt your client. I said, absolutely. He says, you can't do that. But this is a mediation. It's very different. And the same way that they're telling you over and over again, it's our last offer. It happens all the time. It's never the last offer. I mean, eventually it's the last offer. So everybody knows it's a bluff. Everybody knows that when you're going in, you're bluffing. It's almost like it's a game. It's like an agreed rules of the game. So in the mediation context, I think it's okay. But not anywhere else. I'm not telling you this is okay outside the mediation room, not at a trial, not at an arbitration, not at a deposition, not at a client interview. I don't want you to walk out of here thinking, oh, the Russian chief told me it's okay to bend the truth in order to make more money. No, at a mediation, it's okay to say my client said no when the client really wants to say yes, because you're bluffing just like they're bluffing. Now, somebody called me out on this once and said, why can't you just say instead, I can't recommend that amount to my client. That way you're not lying. And the answer is that negotiation, I feel, is more of an art than a science. And if I announce, you know, my client's really okay with the number, I'm the problem. I don't think I'm going to do as well. I think that if I'm seen as being obstructionist or I'm the impediment to a settlement, I don't think we're going to do as well. I find it's more effective when it's the client saying no, not me. And realize that for all I know, right now as we speak, the defense lawyer in that case might be at a conference for lawyers out in the desert. Lawyers like to have conferences in the desert. So do people from other professions. You get on a plane, you fly, all you see is sand and sand and sand. And next thing you know, you see neon lights and you're in Vegas. Okay. So he might be at a conference in Vegas right now doing a presentation, telling this story over saying, and Rothenberg took 3. The carrier said I could have paid 4. I don't know. Maybe I left $1 million on the table. I have no way of knowing that. He's bluffing like I'm blowing. Bluffing. It's our last offer. And I'm sure a lot of lawyers would have taken his final offer at $1.5 million. And maybe there are better lawyers than me who would have held out and said, nope, it's got to be 3.5. And so I am comfortable having spoken to the rabbi, to the Rosh Yeshiva, that what I'm doing is okay. But I wonder. So while practicing, what I wonder is, have I served both of my masters? I've got the secular law that regulates my conduct as an attorney and tells me that I have to fight and fight and fight for my clients to the nth degree. I have to be a zealous advocate while seeking resolution on their behalf. We're looking for winners. Of course, I want my client to be a winner. Remember also, I work on a contingent fee. So if my client's not a winner, if I take on a case and put in time and effort and money and that client loses, I'm the biggest loser because I get a 0. I don't get my time paid for. I don't get my costs reimbursed. I end up with a gigantic bagel, but it's not just a 0. The client ends up with 0. I end up with a negative because I put in 1,000 lawyer hours or more, thousands, and I put in thousands of dollars, maybe tens of thousands of dollars, could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if I lose, that's a big problem. So we want winners and I want my client to be the winner. On the other hand, there's higher authority, and that higher authority says that you have to distance yourself from falsehood. So, you know, my concern is that when I pursue resolution, because that's what we're interested in, when I'm hired, we want resolution. We do not want ties. We can't go back to my client and say, you know, we tied. We tied. Did I win or did I lose? And we want a win and we want a big number next to that win. But when I pursue resolution at the occasional cost of truth, have I sold my soul for a bag of gold coins, as it were? And I'm concerned about that because not a day goes by. I gave you some extreme examples of the temptation. And I gave you that example of the fellow, my friend, who after I explained it to him said, I fell on the sidewalk. But you know, and I know, and I'd be kidding myself if I didn't think that there weren't times when I went through that exact same conversation and somebody said, oh, it's definitely the stairs. And how do I know? How in the world am I supposed to know whether they're telling the truth or not? So I have to be very, very careful while straddling that line. It's not a simple line to straddle. So I hope not. I hope I haven't sold my soul. I believe, and I have good reason to, and authorities that back me up on this, so it's not just my belief, that we're here to struggle. That's what we're here for. We're here, for think back to Jacob, to Yaakov fighting with Esav's angel. We are here to struggle. That's why we're put here. You're given a test and you're wondering, can I pass this test? There's one way to tell. Are you having a test right now? Because if you're having a test right now, you can pass the test. God does not give us tests that we cannot pass. My father has never appeared to me and said, son, with a knife in his hand, son, God told me to bring you up as a sacrifice. I'd be like, dad, put the knife down. No, son, God told me to kill you. Okay. I'd be like, dad, listen, there are people we could talk to. We can get help. Okay. Okay. God doesn't give my father that test, doesn't give me that test because I can't pass that test. You get tested, you can pass. And some of us, and the more tests you pass, the more difficult they become, as you may already know or will find out. So we're told that this very famous saying that man is the sum total of his experiences. Meaning if you want to get the measure of a person, go through their travel log of life, go through everything they've done in their personal life and in their careers. And when you add that all up together, now you get the measure of the person. I don't think that that's true. Or at best, it's half true, which means it's not true. It's interesting. Even in our language in the secular court, we always want people to swear that they're going to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, implying that if somebody tells a half truth, not the whole truth, that that's not true. And we know that to be the case. You leave out important details. What do you mean? Everything I said was true. Yeah, but you left out important details. So the picture you painted was not a true picture. And so what I think is a better description of the sum total of man is that man is the sum total of his choices. Because every time you have an experience that you chose, remember, we're suggesting that man is the sum total of his experiences. Well, one second. Every time you chose an experience, that means you left another experience behind. And that other experience might have been one that was morally superior or morally inferior. Whenever we're faced with that test and I give into that temptation, so now I've had that experience that I chose, but there was a better one that I could have chosen that I left behind. And so I think it's more accurate to say that we're the sum total of our choices and we have to live with those choices. We have to look at ourselves in the mirror every morning. We can't wear a mask. And we know, we can give lip service and we can pray and we can beat our hearts. And we can do a lot of repenting on Yom Kippur and we can assure God that, yes, of course, I know that all my wealth comes from you and I know you're the one that decides, but our actions sometimes belie our words. And if we say that and we mouth those words all the time, God, please, you hold the key to Parnassa, you hold the key to wealth, you hold the key to income. I'm asking you to grant it to me and I'm asking you to grant it to me for all the right reasons so that I can be charitable and I can do acts of kindness and so I can support my family, so I can support the community and I can support the synagogue. And we really do mean that. But then if we go out and lie, cheat and steal, well, one second, like the jig is up. Your actions belie the words. You're claiming that you believe it all comes from God, but then you're showing that you don't really believe that. Because you believed it all came from God, then why are you lying, cheating, corners and cutting corners and stealing? And that goes with cheating clients and cheating adversaries and cheating on taxes and the like. And so we have to be careful with that. Hopefully we'll be able to, to look ourselves in the mirror every morning or the morning after tough moral decisions and not have to kind of avert our eyes or say, oh, good thing I don't have my lenses in yet, because I don't know if I'd be able to, to face that guy in the mirror who did that thing. It should be the opposite. It should be, looking at the mirror saying, look at that, look at that, the same way by analogy, when he's faced with, for my money, the worst situation, the most difficult temptation anyone ever, 17-year-old young Yosef is, he's sold by his brothers. He's in Egypt. He's the only Jew in the entire country. And his master's wife has decided that, and who, by the way, we're told was the most beautiful woman in the world. And the Medrash goes into all sorts of detail, how she changed her clothes twice a day and put on perfumes and had all these different, plans to try to seduce him. And finally, he's just like, according to some, he's about to give in. He's like, I can't handle it anymore. I can't handle it any longer. And everybody's outside the house. It's only her and him. and she grabs on those garments, and he sees his father's image in the window. And I have to think that the most plausible explanation for that is that he conjured that image up. He realized, I have nothing left. I can't do this anymore. And the only way I'm going to get through this is to conjure up the image of my saintly father. And he constructs a conversation in his mind that Talmud records is an unbelievable conversation. He says, his father says to him, Joseph, you know that your name someday is going to be on the stones that are going to be on the breastplate of the high priest of the Kohen Gadol. He says, but if you give in to this, instead, they're not going to be there. And instead, you're going to be known as somebody who consorts with women of ill repute. Is that what you want? And after he constructs this imaginary conversation while looking at his father's image, it's his way of summoning up just enough courage to break out and to leave. And so we all have to have things like that, you know, where we can go back to moral guide stars, whether it's our parents or it's our rabbinic figures or it's the texts or it's the Jewish law, that in moments of weakness, we can hopefully conjure up the right image and the right conversation and then make the right decision. My first work-related adversarial call is tomorrow at 9:30 in the morning. So wish me luck while I try to continue to serve both masters, walk that tightrope, and hopefully make the right decisions. I'm finished now. I wanted to leave some time for questions. If anybody has any, I'm happy to answer them, and hope you enjoyed this.
Very good. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If someone has a question, you do have to unmute yourself before the question or comment. I just wanted to weigh in on one point that you made early on.
Please.
About the question of the case of the fraud with the shrapnel in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
I off the top of my head, I can't bring any proofs to what would happen in a Beis Din. I'm certainly not a dayan and a judge in the Beis Din. You do come across numerous cases of Talmudic law where, because of technicalities, or a rule not being followed properly or so on, where the judge in the Beis Din will say, you're right, you know, you should have won this case, but because you went about it the wrong way or you said the wrong thing, a classic example would be a migu is, believe me, on claim A, then I'm not lying because I could have said claim B and gotten away with it. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a liar, I could have said claim B. And if that argument, if the person just says one word one way or the other, the whole thing can work or it can fly out the window. And it becomes very, very technical. And even though we may know that he's absolutely telling the truth, but, you know, again, you do have the idea of very technical in a Beis Din as well. And sometimes the judge may say, you'll have cases in the Talmud where the judge will say, I'm sorry, but you messed up the way you presented the claim and therefore you can't win.
Right. I agree with you. I would just point out, and I very much enjoy, as you can guess, the Talmudic back and forth, is that in the instance you're describing, the person would have won, but for the technicality, meaning, as you pointed out, we know you're telling the truth, but you didn't say it the right way. Here, we know somebody's not telling the truth, meaning we know at the end of the day that it was a false claim. The whole claim at the outset. And that's why the two judges who dissented said, listen, we get it. Stricken answer, you can't have any defense, but fraud's not a defense. Fraud is at the outset. There was no claim. The claim is built on sand. And that's what's so interesting. So I don't know. It'd be interesting to go through to try to find an analogy like that where this guy is getting paid money from someone else and we know that he does not deserve it. I don't know that we'd find an analogy. But your point's well taken. Yeah, sure, there are technicalities in Beis Din.
Okay. So anyone else would like to weigh in? Okay, so we'll stop it here.
Thank you so very much. If people enjoyed, I do a short weekly video on the Parsha, on the Torah portion of the week and on Jewish holidays. It's easy to find. You can find it on YouTube, on Facebook. Just put in Harry's video blog. It's on Torah Anytime. Much shorter. It's only 3 minutes long on average. You may enjoy that as well. And, great to see you all. And like I said, thanks for the invitation and thank you for the opportunity.